I started out by driving past Morelli's mother's house, his cousin's house, and various other relatives' houses. I circled the parking lot to his apartment, noting that the Nova was still where I'd left it. I cruised up and down Stark Street and Polk. I didn't see the van or anything else that might indicate Morelli's presence. I drove by the front of Carmen's building, and then I went around back. The service road cutting the block was narrow and badly maintained, pocked with holes. There was no tenant parking back here. The single rear door opened onto the service road. Across the way, asphalt-shingled row houses also butted up to the road. I parked as close to the apartment building as possible, leaving barely enough room for a car to squeeze by me. I got out and looked up, trying to place Carmen's second-floor apartment, surprised to see two boarded and fire-blackened windows. The windows belonged to the Santiago apartment. The street-level back door was propped open, and the acrid odor of smoke and charred wood hung in the air. I heard the sweep of a broom and realized someone was working in the narrow corridor that led to the front foyer. A trickle of sooty water tumbled over the sill, and a dark-skinned, mustached man looked out at me. He cut his eyes to my car and jerked his head in the direction of the road. No parking here. I gave him my card. I'm looking for Joe Morelli. He's in violation of his bond agreement. Last I saw him, he was flat on his back out cold. Did you see him get hit? No. I didn't get there until after the police. My apartment's in the cellar. Sound doesn't carry good. I looked up at the damaged windows. What happened? Fire in the Santiago apartment. Happened on Friday. I guess if you wanted to be picky, you'd say it happened Saturday. Was about 2 in the morning. Thank God no one was home. Mrs. Santiago was at her daughter's. She was babysitting. Usually the kids come here, but on Friday she went to their place.
Anybody know how it started?
Could have started a million ways. Not everything's up to code in a building like this. Not that this building's so bad compared to some others, but it's not new. You know what I mean?
I shaded my eyes and took one last look and wondered how hard it'd be to lob a firebomb through Mrs. Santiago's bedroom window. Probably not hard, I decided. And at 2 in the morning, in an apartment this size, a fire started in a bedroom would be a bitch. If Santiago had been home, she'd have been toast. There were no balconies and no fire escapes. All of these apartments had only one way out, through the front door. Although it didn't seem as though Carmen and the missing witness had left through the front door. I turned and stared into the dark windows of the row houses across the way and decided it wouldn't hurt to question the residents. I got back into the Cherokee and drove around the block, finding a parking place one street over. I rapped on doors and asked questions and showed pictures. The responses were all similar. No, they didn't recognize Morelli's picture. And no, they hadn't seen anything unusual from their back windows on the night of the murder or the fire. I tried the row house directly across from Carmen's apartment and found myself face to face with a stooped old man wielding a baseball bat. He was beady-eyed and hooked-nosed and had ears that probably kept him indoors when the wind was blowing. "Batting practice?" I asked. "Can't be too careful," he said. I identified myself and asked if he'd seen Morelli. "Nope, never seen him. And I got better things to do than to look out my damn windows. Couldn't have seen anything anyway on the night of the murder. It was dark. How the hell was I supposed to see anything?"
There are street lights back there, I said. It looks to me like it would be pretty well lit.
The lights were out that night. I told this to the cops that came around. The damn lights are always out. Kids shoot them out. I know they were out because I looked to see what all the noise was about. I could hardly hear my TV, what with all the noise from the cop cars and the trucks. The first time I looked out, it was because of the motor running on one of them refrigerator trucks, like from a food store. Damn thing was parked right behind my house. I tell you, the neighborhood's going to hell. People got no consideration. They park trucks and delivery cars here in the alley all the time while they do personal visits. Shouldn't be allowed.
I nodded in vague affirmation, thinking it was a good thing I owned a gun, because if I ever got this crotchety, I'd want to kill myself. He took my nod as encouragement and kept going.
Then the next truck to come along was a police wagon, about the same size as the refrigerator truck, and they left their motor running too. These guys must have gas to burn.
So then you didn't really see anything suspicious?
Was too damn dark, I'm telling you. King Kong could have been climbing up that wall and nobody would have seen.
I thanked him for his help and walked back to the Jeep. It was close to noon, and the air was crackling hot. I drove to my cousin Rooney's bar, snagged an ice-cold six-pack, and headed for Stark Street. Lula and Jackie were hawking wares on the corner, just like always. They were sweating and swaying in the heat, yelling out intimate pet names and graphic suggestions to potential customers. I parked close by, set the six-pack on the hood, and popped one open. Lula eyed the beer.
"You trying to lure us away from our corner, girl?"
I grinned. I sort of liked them. "Thought you might be thirsty."
"Shit. Thirsty ain't the half of it."
Lula sauntered over, took a beer, and chugged some.
"Don't know why I'm wasting my time standing out. Nobody want to fuck in this weather."
Jackie followed.
"You shouldn't be doing that," she warned Lula. "Your old man gonna get mad."
"Huh," Lula said. "I suppose I care. Dumbass prick pimp. Don't see him standing out here in the sun, do you?"
"So what's the word on Morelli?" I asked. "Anything happening?"
"Haven't seen him," Lula said. "Haven't seen the van, neither."
"You hear anything about Carmen?"
"Like what?"
"Like, is she around somewhere?" Lula was wearing a halter top with a lot of boob hanging out. She rolled the cold can of beer across her chest. I figured it was a wasted effort. She'd need a keg to cool off a chest that size.
"Don't hear nothing about Carmen."
An ugly thought flashed through my mind. Carmen ever spend time with Ramirez?
"Sooner or later, everybody spend time with Ramirez."
"You ever spend time with him?"
"Not me. He liked to do his magic on skinny pussy."
"Suppose he wanted to do his magic on you. Would you go with him?"
"Honey, nobody refuses Ramirez nothing."
"I hear he abuses women."
"Lots of men abuse women," Jackie said. "Sometimes men get in a mood."
"Sometimes they're sick," I said. "Sometimes they're freaks. I hear Ramirez is a freak." Lula looked down the street to the gym, her eyes locked on the second-story windows.
"Yeah," she said softly. "He's a freak. He scares me. I had a friend go with Ramirez, and he cut her bad."
"Cut her? With a knife?"
"No," she said. "With a beer bottle. Broke the neck and then used it to, you know, do the deed."
I felt my head go light, and time stood still for a moment.
How do you know it was Ramirez?
People know.
People don't know nothing, Jackie said. People shouldn't be talking. Somebody gonna hear, and you be in for it. Be all your own fault, too, 'cause you know better than to go shooting off your mouth.
I'm not staying here and being party to this. Nuh-uh. Not me. I'm going back to my corner. You know what's good for you, you'll come too.
I know what's good for me. I wouldn't be standing out here at all, would I?
Lula said, moving off. Be careful, I called after her.
Big woman like me don't gotta be careful, she said. I just stomp on them weird-ass motherfuckers. Nobody mess with Lula.
I stashed the rest of the beer in the car, slid behind the wheel, and locked the doors. I started the engine and turned the air on full blast, positioning all the vents so the cold hit me in the face. Come on, Stephanie, I said. Get a grip. But I couldn't get a grip. My heart was racing, and my throat was closed tight with grief for a woman I didn't even know. A woman who must have suffered terribly. I wanted to get as far away from Stark Street as was humanly possible and never come back. I didn't want to know about these things, didn't want the terror of it creeping into my consciousness at unguarded moments. I hung onto the wheel and looked down the street at the second-floor gym and was rocked with rage and horror that Ramirez hadn't been punished and that he was free to mutilate and terrorize other women. I lunged out of the car, slammed the door closed, and stalked across the street to Alpha's office building, taking the stairs two at a time. I barreled past his secretary and threw the door to Alpha's inner office open with enough force to make it crash against the wall. Alpha jumped in his chair. I leaned palms down on his desktop and got right in his face. I got a phone call last night from your fighter. He was brutalizing some young woman, and he was trying to terrorize me with her suffering. I know all about his previous rape charges, and I know about his fondness for sexual mutilation. I don't know how he's managed to escape prosecution this far, but I'm here to tell you his luck has run out. Either you stop him, or else I'll stop him. I'll go to the police. I'll go to the press. I'll go to the fight commissioner. Don't do that. I'll take care of it. I swear, I'll take care of it. I'll get him into counseling. Today. Yeah, today. I promise. I'll get him some help. I didn't believe it for a second. But I'd said my piece, so I left in the same whirlwind of bad temper that I'd entered. I forced myself to breathe deep on the stairs and cross the street with a calmness I didn't feel. I pulled out of the parking space and very slowly, very carefully, drove away. It was still early in the day, but I'd lost my energy for the hunt. My car headed home of its own volition, and next thing I knew, I was in my parking lot. I locked up, climbed the stairs to my apartment, flopped down on the bed, and assumed my thinking position. I woke up at 3 and felt better. While I was sleeping, my mind had obviously been hard at work finding secluded repositories for my latest collection of depressing thoughts. They were still with me, but they were no longer forcefully pressing against my forehead. I made myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, gave a bite of it to Rex, and scarfed the rest down while I accessed Morelli's messages. A photo studio had called with an offer of a free 8x10 if Morelli came in for a sitting. Someone wanted to sell him light bulbs, and Charlene called with an indecent suggestion, did some heavy panting, and either had a hell of an orgasm or else stepped on her cat's tail. Unfortunately, she also ran the tape out, so there were no more messages.
It was just as well. I couldn't have managed listening to much more. I was straightening the kitchen when the phone rang, and the machine picked it up.
"Are you listening, Stephanie? Are you home? I saw you talking to Lula and Jackie today. Saw you drinking beer with them. I didn't like that, Stephanie. Made me feel bad. Made me feel like you liked them better than me. Made me angry because you don't want what the champ want to give you. Maybe I'll give you a present, Stephanie. Maybe I'll deliver it to your door when you're sleeping. Would you like that? All women like presents. Especially the kind of presents the champ gives. Gonna be a surprise, Stephanie. Gonna be just for you."
With that promise ringing in my ears, I made sure my gun and my bullets were in my pocketbook, and I took off for Sonny's. I got there at 4 and waited in the lot until Eddie showed up at 4:15. He was out of uniform, and he had his off-duty 38 clipped to his waist.
"Where's your gun?"
he asked. I patted my pocketbook.
"That's considered carrying concealed. It's a serious offense in New Jersey."
"I have a permit."
"Let me see it."
I pulled the permit out of my wallet.
"This is a permit to own, not to carry," Eddie said.
"Ranger told me it was multi-purpose."
"Ranger gonna come visit you when you're making license plates?"
"Sometimes I think he stretches the limits of the law a trifle. Are you going to arrest me?"
"No, but it's going to cost you."
"Dozen donuts?"
"Dozen donuts is what it takes to fix a parking ticket. This is worth a 6-pack and a pizza."
It was necessary to go through the gun shop to get to the rifle range. Eddie paid the range fee and bought a box of shells. I did the same. The range was directly behind the gun shop and consisted of a room the size of a small bowling alley. 7 booths were partitioned off, each booth with a chest-high shelf. Beyond the booths was known as downrange. Standard targets of ungendered humans cut off at the knees, with bull's-eye rings radiating out from the heart, were hung on pulleys. Range etiquette was never to point the gun at the guy standing next to you.
"Okay," Gazzara said. "Let's start at the beginning. You have a Smith & Wesson 38 Special. It's a 5-shot revolver, which puts it into the category of small gun. You're using hydroshock bullets to cause maximum pain and suffering. This little doohickey here gets pushed forward with your thumb. The cylinder releases, and you can load your gun. A bullet is a round. Load a round in each chamber and click the cylinder closed. Never leave your trigger finger resting on the trigger. It's a natural reflex to squeeze when surprised, and you could end up blowing a hole in your foot. Stretch your trigger finger straight toward the barrel until you're ready to shoot. We're going to use the most basic stance today. Feet shoulder width apart. Weight on the balls of your feet. Hold the gun in both hands. Left thumb over right thumb. Arm straight. Look at the target. Bring the gun up and sight. The front sight is a post. The rear sight is a notch. Line the sights up on the desired spot on the target and fire. This revolver is double action. You can fire by pulling the trigger or by cocking the hammer and then pulling the trigger.
He'd been demonstrating while he talked, doing everything but fire the gun. He released the cylinder, spilled the bullets onto the shelf, laid the gun on the shelf, and stepped back.
"Any questions?"
"No, not yet." He handed me a pair of ear protectors.
"Go for it."
My first shot was single action, and I hit the bullseye. I shot several more rounds single action, and then switched over to double action. This was more difficult to control, but I did pretty well. After a half hour, I'd used up all my ammo, and I was shooting erratically from muscle fatigue. Usually when I go to the gym, I spend most of my time working abdominals and legs, because that's where my fat goes. If I was going to be any good at shooting, I was going to have to get more upper body strength. Eddie pulled my target in. "Damn fair shooting, Tex." "I'm better at single action." "That's 'cause you're a girl." "You don't want to say stuff like that when I've got a gun in my hand." I bought a box of shells before I left. I dropped the shells into my pocketbook along with my gun. I was driving a stolen car. Worrying about carrying concealed at this point seemed like overkill. "So do I get my pizza now?" Eddie wanted to know. "What about Shirley?" "Shirley's at a baby shower." "The kids?" "Mother-in-law." "What about your diet?" "You trying to get out of buying this pizza?" "I've only got $12.33 distinguishing me from the bag lady at the train station." "Okay, I'll buy the pizza." "Good. I need to talk. I have problems." 10 minutes later, we met at Pino's Pizzeria. There were several Italian restaurants in the burg, but Pino's was the place to get pizza. I was told at night cockroaches as big as barn cats came out to raid the kitchen, but the pizza was first rate. Crust that was crisp and puffy, homemade sauce, and enough grease from the pepperoni to run down your arm and drip off your elbow. There was a bar and a family room. Late at night, the bar was filled with off-duty cops trying to wind down before they went home. At this time of the day, the bar was filled with men waiting for takeout. We got a table in the family room and asked for a pitcher while we waited for the pizza. There was a shaker of crushed hot pepper in the middle of the table, and another shaker of Parmesan. The tablecloth was red and white check plastic. The walls were paneled and lacquered to a shiny gloss and decorated with framed photos of famous Italians and a few non-Italian locals. Frank Sinatra and Benito Ramirez were the dominant celebs. "So what's the problem?" Eddie wanted to know. Two problems. Number one, Joe Morelli. I've run into him 4 times since I've taken on this assignment, and I've never once come close to making an apprehension.
"Are you afraid of him?"
"No, but I am afraid to use my gun."
"Then do it the ladies' way. Spray him and cuff him."
Easier said than done, I thought. It's hard to spray a man when he has his tongue down your throat. That was my plan, too, but he always moves faster than I do.
"You want my advice? Forget Morelli. You're a beginner, and he's a pro. He has years of experience behind him. He was a smart cop, and he's probably even better at being a felon."
"Forgetting Morelli isn't an option. I'd like you to run a couple car checks for me." I wrote the van's license number on a napkin and gave it to him. "See if you can find out who owns this. I'd also like to know if Carmen Sanchez owns a car, and if she does own a car, has it been impounded?" I drank some beer and slouched back, enjoying the cold air and the buzz of conversation around me. Every table was filled now, and there was a knot of people waiting at the door. No one wanted to cook when it got this hot.
"So, what's the second problem?" Eddie asked.
"If I tell you, you have to promise not to get overwrought." "Christ, you're pregnant." I stared at him, nonplussed. "Why would you think that?" His expression was sheepish.
"I don't know. It just popped out. It's what Shirley always says to me."
Gazzara had 4 kids.
The oldest was 9. The youngest was 1 year. They were all boys, and they were all monsters. Well, I'm not pregnant. It's Ramirez. I gave him the full story on Ramirez.
You should have filed a report on him, Gazara said. Why didn't you call the police when you got roughed up in the gym?
Would Ranger have filed a report if he got roughed up?
You're not Ranger.
That's true. But you see my point?
Why are you telling me this?
I guess if I suddenly disappear, I want you to know where to start looking.
Jesus. If you think he's that dangerous, you should get a restraining order.
I don't have a lot of confidence in a restraining order. Besides, what am I going to tell the judge? That Ramirez threatened to send me a present? Look around you. What do you see?
Eddie sighed. Pictures of Ramirez side by side with the Pope and Frank Sinatra.
I'm sure I'll be fine, I said. I just needed to tell someone.
If you have any more problems, I want you to call me right away.
I nodded.
When you're home alone, make sure your gun is loaded and accessible. Could you use it on Ramirez if you had to?
I don't know. I think so.
Scheduling got screwed up, and I'm working days again. I want you to meet me at Sonny's every day at 4:30. I'll buy the ammo and pay the range fee. The only way to feel comfortable with a gun is to use it.
Chapter 10. I was home by 9, and for lack of something better to do, I decided to clean my apartment. There were no messages on my machine, and no suspicious packages on my doorstep. I gave Rex new bedding, vacuumed the carpet, scrubbed the bathroom, and polished the few pieces of furniture I had left. This brought me up to 10. I checked one last time to make sure everything was locked, took a shower, and went to bed. I awoke at 7, feeling elated. I'd slept like a brick. My machine was still gloriously message-free. Birds were warbling, the sun was shining, and I could see my reflection in my toaster. I pulled on shorts and shirt and started coffee brewing. I opened the living room curtains and gasped at the magnificence of the day. The sky was a brilliant blue. The air was still washed clean from the rain. And I had an overwhelming desire to belt out something from The Sound of Music. I sang, "The hills are alive with the sound of music." But then I didn't know any more words. I twirled myself into my bedroom and threw the curtain open with a flourish. I froze at the sight of Lula tied to my fire escape. She hung there like a big rag doll, her arms crooked over the railing at an unnatural angle, her head slumped forward onto her chest. Her legs were splayed so that she seemed to be sitting. She was naked and blood-smeared. The blood caked in her hair and clotted on her legs. A sheet had been draped behind her to hide her from view of the parking lot. I shouted her name and clawed at the lock, my heart hammering so hard in my chest that my vision blurred. I heaved the window open and half fell onto the fire escape, reaching out for her, tugging ineffectually at her bindings. Lula didn't move, didn't utter a sound, and I couldn't collect myself enough to tell if she was breathing.
"You're going to be okay," I cried, my voice sounding hoarse, my throat closed tight, my lungs burning. "I'm going to get help."
And under my breath I sobbed, "Don't be dead. God, Lula, don't be dead." I floundered back through the window to call for an ambulance, caught my foot on the sill and crashed to the floor. There was no pain, only panic as I scrambled on hands and knees to the phone. I couldn't remember the emergency number.
My mind had shut down in the face of hysteria, leaving me to cope helplessly with the confusion and denial accompanying sudden and unexpected tragedy. I punched zero and told the operator Lula was hurt on my fire escape. I had a flashback of Jackie Kennedy crawling over the car seat to get help for her dead husband, and I burst into tears, crying for Lula and Jackie and for myself, all victims of violence. I clattered through the cutlery drawer, looking for my paring knife, finally finding it in the dish drainer. I had no idea how long Lula had been tied to the railing, but I couldn't bear her hanging there seconds longer. I ran back with the knife and sawed at the ropes until they were severed, and Lula collapsed into my arms. She was almost twice my size, but somehow I dragged her inert, bloodied body through the window. My instincts were to hide and protect. Stephanie Plum, Mother Cat. I heard the sirens wailing from far away, getting closer and closer, and then the police were pounding on my door. I don't remember letting them in, but obviously I did. A uniformed cop took me aside into the kitchen and sat me down on a chair. A medic followed. "What happened?" the cop asked. "I found her on the fire escape," I said. I opened the curtains, and there she was. My teeth were chattering, and my heart was still racing in my chest. I gulped in air. "She was tied to keep her up, and I cut her down and dragged her through the window." I could hear the medic shouting to bring the stretcher. There was the sound of my bed being shoved aside to make room. I was afraid to ask if Lula was alive. I sucked in more air and clenched my hands in my lap until my knuckles turned white and my nails dug into the fleshy part of my palm. "Does Lula live here?" the cop wanted to know. "No, I live here. I don't know where Lula lives. I don't even know her last name." The phone rang, and I automatically reached out to answer. The caller's voice whispered from the handset. "Did you get my present, Stephanie?" It was as if the earth suddenly stopped rotating. There was a moment of feeling off balance, and then everything snapped into focus. I pushed the record button on the machine and turned up the volume so everyone could hear. "What present are you talking about?" I asked.
"You know what present. I saw you find her. Saw you drag her back through the window. I've been watching you. I could have come and got you last night when you were asleep, but I wanted you to see Lula. I wanted you to see what I can do to a woman, so you know what to expect. I want you to think about it, bitch. I want you to think about how it's going to hurt and how you are going to beg."
"You like to hurt women?" I asked, control beginning to return.
"Sometimes women need to be hurt."
I decided to take a winger.
"How about Carmen Sanchez?
Did you hurt her?"
"Not as good as I'm going to hurt you. I have special things planned for you."
"No time like the present," I said. And I was shocked to realize that I meant it. There was no bravado in the statement. I was in the grip of cold, hard, sphincter-cramping fury.
"The cops are there now, bitch. I'm not coming when the cops are there. I'm going to get you when you're alone and you're not expecting me. I'm going to make sure we have lots of time together."
The connection was broken. "Jesus Christ," the uniform said. "He's crazy."
"Do you know who that was?" I'm afraid to guess.
I popped the tape out of the machine and wrote my name and the date on the label. My hand was shaking so badly the writing was barely readable. A handheld radio crackled from the living room. I could hear the murmur of voices in my bedroom. The voices were less frantic, and the rhythm of activity had become more orderly. I looked at myself and realized I was covered with Lula's blood. It had soaked into my shirt and shorts, and it was coagulating on my hands and the bottoms of my bare feet. The phone was tacky with blood smears, as was the floor and the counter. The cop and the medic exchanged glances.
"Maybe you should get that blood washed off," the medic said. "How about we get you into the shower real fast?"
I looked in at Lula on my way to the bathroom. They were getting ready to move her out. She was strapped to the stretcher, covered with a sheet and blanket. She was hooked up to an IV.
"How is she?" I asked.
A squad member tugged the stretcher forward.
"Alive," he said.
The medics were gone when I got out of the shower. Two uniformed cops had stayed, and the one who talked to me in the kitchen was conferring with the PC in the living room, the two of them going over notes. I dressed quickly and left my hair to dry on its own. I was anxious to make my statement and be done with it. I wanted to get to the hospital to see about Lula. The PC's name was Dorsey. I'd seen him before, probably at Pino's. He was medium height, medium build, and looked to be in his late 40s. He was in shirt sleeves and slacks and penny loafers. I could see my recorder tape tucked into his shirt pocket. Exhibit A. I told him about the incident in the gym, omitting Morelli's name, leaving Dorsey to think the identity of my rescuer was unknown. If the police wanted to believe Morelli'd left town, that was fine with me. I still had hopes of bringing him in and collecting my money. Dorsey took a lot of notes and looked knowingly at the patrolman. He didn't seem surprised. I suppose if you're a cop long enough, nothing surprises you. When they left, I shut off the coffee maker, closed and locked the bedroom window, grabbed my pocketbook, and squared my shoulders to what I knew awaited me in the hall. I was going to have to make my way past Mrs. Orbach, Mr. Grossman, Mrs. Finesmith, Mr. Woleski, and who knows how many others. They would want to know the details, and I wasn't up to imparting details. I put my head down, shouted apologies, and went straight for the stairs, knowing that would slow them. I bolted out of the building and ran to the Cherokee. I took St. James to Olden and cut across Trenton to Stark. It would have been easier to go straight to St. Francis Hospital, but I wanted to get Jackie. I barreled down Stark and passed the gym without a sideways glance. As far as I was concerned, Ramirez was finished. If he slipped through the loopholes of the law on this one, I'd get him myself. I'd cut off his dick with a carving knife if I had to. Jackie was coming out of the corner bar, where I imagined she'd had breakfast. I screeched to a stop and half hung out the door. "Get in!" I yelled to Jackie. "What's this about?" "Lula's in the hospital. Ramirez got to her."
"Oh, God," she wailed. "I was so afraid. I knew something was wrong. How bad is it?"
"I honestly don't know. I found her on my fire escape just now. Ramirez had left her tied there as a message to me. She's unconscious."
"I was there when he came for her. She didn't want to go. But you don't say no to Benito Ramirez. Her old man would have beat her bloody."
"Yeah? Well, she's been beaten bloody anyway." I found a parking place on Hamilton, one block from the emergency entrance. I set the alarm, and Jackie and I took off at a trot. She had about 200 pounds on the hoof, and she wasn't even breathing hard when we pushed through the double glass doors. I guess humping all day keeps you in shape. A woman named Lula was just brought in by ambulance, I told the clerk. The clerk looked at me, and then she looked at Jackie. Jackie was dressed in poison green shorts with half her ass hanging out, matching rubber sandals, and a hot pink tank top. "Are you family?" she asked Jackie.
"Lula don't got any family here."
"We need someone to fill out forms."
"I guess I could do that," she said.
When we were done with the forms, we were told to sit and wait. We did this in silence, aimlessly thumbing through torn magazines, watching with inhuman detachment as one tragedy after another rolled down the hall. After a half hour, I asked about Lula and was told she was an X-ray. "How long would she be an X-ray?" I asked. The clerk didn't know. It would be a while, but then a doctor would come out to talk to us. I reported this to Jackie.
"Huh," she said. "I bet."
I was a quart down on caffeine, so I left Jackie to wait and went in search of the cafeteria. I was told to follow the footprints on the floor, and darned if they didn't bring me to food. I loaded a takeout carton with pastries, 2 large coffees, and added 2 oranges just in case Jackie and I felt the need to be healthy. I thought it was unlikely, but I figured it was like wearing clean panties in case of a car crash. It never hurt to be prepared. An hour later, we saw the doctor. He looked at me, and he looked at Jackie. Jackie hiked up her top and tugged at her shorts. It was a futile gesture.
"Are you family?"
he asked Jackie.
"I guess so," Jackie said. "What's the word?"
"The prognosis is guarded but hopeful. She's lost a lot of blood, and she's suffered some head trauma.
She has multiple wounds that need suturing. She's being taken to surgery. It will probably be a while before she's brought to her room. You might want to go out and come back in an hour or two."
"I'm not going nowhere," Jackie said.
2 hours dragged by without further information. We'd eaten all the pastries and were forced to eat the oranges.
"Don't like this," Jackie said. "Don't like being cooped up in institutions. Whole fucking place smells like canned green beans."
"Spend much time in institutions, have you?"
"My share."
She didn't seem inclined to elaborate, and I didn't actually want to know anyway. I fidgeted in my chair, looked around the room, and spotted Dorsey talking to the clerk. He was nodding, getting answers to questions. The clerk pointed to Jackie and me, and Dorsey ambled over.
"How's Lula?" he asked. "Any news?"
"She's in surgery." He settled himself into the seat next to me.
"We haven't been able to pick up Ramirez yet. You have any idea where he might be? He say anything interesting before you started recording?"
"He said he was watching me pull Lula through the window, and he knew the police were in my apartment. He must have been close."
"Probably on a car phone,"
I agreed. "Here's my card." He wrote a number on the back. "This is my home phone. You see Ramirez, or you get another call, get in touch right away." "It'll be hard for him to hide," I said. "He's a local celebrity. He's easy to recognize." Dorsey returned his pen to an inside jacket pocket, and I got a glimpse of his hip holster.
"There are a lot of people in this city who'll go out of their way to hide and protect Benito Ramirez. We've been this route with him before.
Yes, but you've never had a tape.
True. The tape might make a difference.
Won't make no difference,
Jackie said when Dorsey left.
Ramirez do what he want. Nobody cares about him beating on a whore.
We care, I said to Jackie. We can stop him. We can get Lula to testify against him.
Huh,
Jackie said.
You don't know much.
It was 3 before we were allowed to see Lula. She hadn't regained consciousness and was in ICU. Our visit was restricted to 10 minutes each. I squeezed her hand and promised her she'd be okay. When my time was up, I told Jackie I had an appointment I needed to keep. She said she was staying until Lula opened her eyes. I got to Sonny's a half hour before Gazara. I paid my fee, bought a box of shells, and went back to the range. I shot a few with the hammer pulled back, and then settled in for serious practice. I envisioned Ramirez in front of the target. I aim for his heart, his balls, his nose. Gazara came on the range at 4:30. He dropped a new box of shells on my loading table and took the booth next to me. By the time I was done with both boxes, I was pleasantly relaxed and feeling comfortable with my gun. I loaded 5 rounds and slid the gun back into my bag. I tapped Gazara on the shoulder and motioned that I was done. He holstered his Glock and followed me out. We waited until we were in the parking lot to talk.
I heard the call come in, he said. Sorry I couldn't get to you. I was in the middle of something.
I saw Dorsey at the station. He said you were cool. Said you switched on the recorder when Ramirez came on the line.
You should have seen me 5 minutes before. I couldn't remember 911.
I don't suppose you'd consider taking a vacation.
It's crossed my mind.
You got your gun in your pocketbook?
Hell no. That would be breaking the law. Gazara sighed. Just don't let anyone see it, okay?
And call me if you get spooked. You're welcome to stay with Shirley and me for as long as you want.
I appreciate it.
I checked on the plate number you gave me. The plates belong to a vehicle seized for a parking violation, impounded, and never retrieved.
I saw Morelli driving said vehicle.
He probably borrowed it.
We both smiled at the thought of Morelli driving a vehicle stolen from the impound yard.
What about Carmen Sanchez? Does she have a car?
Gazara dug a piece of paper out of his pocket.
This is the make and her license number. It hasn't been impounded.
You want me to follow you home? Make sure your apartment's safe?
Not necessary. Half the building's population is probably still camped out in my hall. What I really dreaded was facing the blood. I was going to have to walk into my apartment and face the grisly aftermath of Ramirez's handiwork. Lula's blood would still be on the phone, the walls, the countertops, and the floor. If the sight of that blood triggered a renewed rush of hysteria, I wanted to deal with it alone, in my own way. I parked in the lot and slipped into the building unnoticed. Good timing, I thought. The halls were clear. Everyone was eating dinner. I had my defense spray in my hand and my gun wedged under my waistband. I turned the key in the lock and felt my stomach lurch. Just get it over with, I told myself. Barge right in, check under the bed for rapists, pull on some rubber gloves and clean up the mess. I took a tentative step into my foyer and realized someone was in my apartment. Someone was cooking in the kitchen,
making cozy cooking sounds, clanking pots and running water. Under the clanking, I could hear food sizzling in a frying pan. "Hello?" I called, gun now in hand, barely able to hear myself over the pounding of my heart. "Who's here?" Morelli sauntered out of the kitchen.
"Just me. Put the gun away. We need to talk."
"Jesus! You are so fucking arrogant! Did it ever occur to you I might shoot you with this gun?"
"No, it never occurred to me.
I've been practicing. I'm a pretty good shot."
He moved behind me, closed and locked the door.
"Yeah, I'll bet you're hell on wheels blasting the shit out of those paper men."
"What are you doing in my apartment?"
"I'm cooking dinner."
He went back to his sautéing.
"Rumor has it you've had a tough day."
My mind was spinning. I'd been racking my brain trying to find Morelli, and here he was in my apartment. He even had his back turned to me. I could shoot him in the butt.
"You don't want to shoot an unarmed man," he said, reading my thoughts. "The state of New Jersey frowns on that sort of thing. Take it from someone who knows."
All right, so I wouldn't shoot him. I'd zap him with the SureGuard. His neurotransmitters wouldn't know what hit them. Morelli added some fresh sliced mushrooms to the pan and continued to cook, sending heavenly food smells wafting my way. He was stirring red and green peppers, onions, and mushrooms, and my killer instincts were weakening in direct proportion to the amount of saliva pooling in my mouth. I found myself rationalizing a decision to hold off on the spray, telling myself I needed to hear him out. But the ugly truth was my motives weren't nearly so worthy. I was hungry and depressed, and I was a lot more frightened of Ramirez than I was of Joe Morelli. In fact, I suppose in a bizarre way, I felt safe with Morelli in my apartment. One crisis at a time, I decided. Have some dinner. Gas him for dessert. He turned and looked at me.
"You want to talk about it?"
"Ramirez almost killed Lula and hung her on my fire escape." "Ramirez is like a fungus that feeds on fear. You ever see him in the ring?" "His fans love him, because he goes the distance unless the referee calls the fight. He plays with his opponent, loves to draw blood, loves to punish. And all the time he's punishing, he's talking to his victim in that soothing voice of his, telling them how much worse it's going to get, telling them he'll only stop when they beg to get knocked out. He's like that with women. Likes to see them squirm in fear and pain. Likes to leave his mark." I dumped my pocketbook on the counter. "I know. He's very large on mutilation and begging. In fact, you might say he's obsessed with it." Morelli turned the heat down. "I'm trying to scare you, but I don't think it's working." "I'm all scared out. I don't have any more scare left in me. Maybe tomorrow." I looked around and realized someone had cleaned up the blood.
"Did you scrub the kitchen?"
"The kitchen and the bedroom. You're going to have your carpet professionally cleaned."
"Thank you.
I wasn't looking forward to seeing more blood today."
"Was it bad?"
"Yeah. Her face is battered almost beyond recognition, and she was bleeding everywhere."
My voice broke and hitched in my throat. I looked down at the floor.
"Shit. I have wine in the refrigerator. Why don't you trade in that gun for a couple glasses?"
"Why are you being nice to me?"
"I need you."
"Oh, boy.
Not that way."
"I wasn't thinking that way. All I said was, oh, boy.
What are you making?
Steak. I put it in when you pulled into the parking lot.
He poured the wine and gave me a glass.
You're living a little Spartan here.
I lost my job and couldn't get another. I sold off my furniture to keep going.
That's when you decided to work for Vinny?
I didn't have a lot of options.
So you're after me for the money. It's nothing personal.
In the beginning, it wasn't. He was moving around my kitchen like he'd lived there all his life, setting plates on the counter, pulling a bowl of salad from the refrigerator. It should have seemed invasive and pushy, but it was actually very comfortable. He flipped a rib steak onto each plate, covered them with the peppers and onions, and added a foil-wrapped baked potato. He set out salad dressing, sour cream, and steak sauce, shut the broiler off and wiped his hands on a kitchen towel.
Why is it personal now?
You chained me to the shower rod. Then you made me go rooting around in a dumpster to get my keys. Every time I catch up to you, you do everything possible to humiliate me.
They weren't your keys. They were my keys.
He took a sip of wine and our eyes locked.
You stole my car.
I had a plan. You were going to snag me when I came after my car?
Something like that.
He carried his plate to the table.
I hear Macy's has openings for makeover ladies.
You sound like my mother. Morelli grinned and dug into his steak. The day had been exhausting, and the wine and good food were mellowing me out. We were eating at the table, sitting across from each other, absorbed in the meal like an old married couple. I cleaned my plate and pushed back in my chair.
What do you need from me?
Cooperation. And in return for that cooperation, I'll see to it that you collect your bounty money. You've got my attention. Carmen Sanchez was an informant. One night I'm sitting home watching television, and I get a call from her asking for help. She says she's been raped and beaten. She says she needs money and she needs a safe place to stay. And in return, she's going to give me something big. When I get to her apartment, Ziggy Kulesa answers the door, and Carmen is nowhere in sight. Another guy, better known as the missing witness, comes out of the bedroom, recognizes me from who knows where, and panics. "This guy's a cop," he yells to Ziggy. "I can't believe you opened the door to a goddamn cop." Ziggy draws a gun on me. I return fire and shoot him almost point blank. Next thing I know, I'm staring at the ceiling. The second guy is gone. Carmen's gone. Ziggy's gun is gone.
How could he have missed you at such close range? And if he missed you, where'd the bullet go?
The only explanation I can come up with is that the gun misfired.
And now you want to find Carmen so Carmen can back up your story.
I don't think Carmen's going to be backing up anyone's story. My guess is she was beaten up by Ramirez, and Ziggy and his pal were sent to finish the job. Ziggy did all Ramirez's dirty work.
When you're out on the street like I am, you hear things. Ramirez likes to punish women. Sometimes women last seen in his company are known to disappear. I think he gets carried away and kills them. Or maybe he hurts them so bad he has to send someone to finish the job to keep things quiet. Then the body vanishes. No body, no crime. I think Carmen was dead in the bedroom when I arrived. That's why Ziggy freaked.
"There's only one door," I said.
"And no one saw her leave, dead or alive."
"There's a window in the bedroom that overlooks the service road."
"You think Carmen was pitched out the window?" Morelli took his plate into the kitchen and started coffee brewing.
"I'm looking for the guy who recognized me. Ziggy dropped the gun when he hit the floor. I saw it skitter to the side. When I got hit from behind, Ziggy's partner must have taken the gun, slipped off into the bedroom, dumped Carmen out the window, and followed her.